I set my standards high so your children can have somebody in sports to look up to. And somebody that you can say to your son, listen to that man.
From Television City in Hollywood.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com. The only place to be in your pop culture world.
Discretionary viewer participation is advised for the following professional wrestling exhibition.
Greetings from Allentown is taped in front of a live studio audience.
USA presents International Championship Wrestling, featuring the top stars of the AWA and the NWA.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode number 105 of Greetings from Allentown. I'm your host, Peter Winston, and today I'm going to be taking a look at something very different and very short-lived. And once again, I'm staying in that 1984-85 nexus where I just love to reside. This time, I'll be taking a look at Pro Wrestling USA from October 6, 1984. This would be the second episode of that joint effort of the NWA, mainly Jim Crockett Promotions, the Memphis guys, Jerry Jarrett and Jerry Lawler, getting together with Vern Gagne and the AWA to kind of put up a united front against Vince McMahon and kind of attack him in his home territory, you know, trying to make a foray into the Northeast. What I'm very excited about on this show, other than the fact that it's very original, this, because, you know, I get to talk about some people that I haven't had a chance to in the past. It also has original commercials, which has me very excited, because that can be difficult to find from 1984, and some of them are some pretty funny ads, if I do say so. But first, let me get in my plugs. You can email the show, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com, facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. Give me a follow on Twitter, @GFAllentownPod. That is @GFAllentownPod. And if you have subscribed to my YouTube channel in the past week, thank you so much for that. As I looked earlier, I think I was at 924, so I got 76 to go before I could start getting that Google ad revenue again. Oh, dear God. Thank you so much. I'm going to get there. I swear to God. It was some nice free money that I got back in 2017 before they changed the rules on it and everything. So if you subscribed, thank you very much. I appreciate it. I keep saying that I'm going to add more videos to it. There'll probably be like little short bits or whatever. Might be from wrestling shows. Might just be from the random VHS tapes that I have lying around. Of course, it means I'll have to get back to the business of dubbing them over, and I do have other things to do. Like, I have to take down all my stuff from the walls in my basement because we're getting it professionally painted down here because, there's a lot of wall to actually paint. So that means my 14 albums going to come down, my Read a Book on Canada poster, all my Orioles, Bruins, all that sort of stuff, my Mad Men poster. I'm just naming things that I'm looking at. I know I'm like Brick Tamlin at this point. I'm kind of sad because my hockey rink in my backyard was kind of fading out on me over the weekend because it rained all day on Sunday. And rain is pretty bad for the ice if you want to actually skate on it at the time. But I think I may have gotten a lucky break in that pretty much since Sunday, the temperatures have been below freezing up here. So I'm probably going to give it a spin over the next couple of days to see how well the ice is holding up. I mean, I shoveled just about everything out of the way so that, I moved the snow up against my deck so that the puck would not go under the deck. Yeah, I take a stick and a puck out there because, you know, if I'm just skating around, I feel a little foolish, so I'll just shoot the puck from one end of the ice to the other. But, you know, whatever. So that's fine. I did live up to one of my New Year's resolutions over the weekend by going to Chaotic Wrestling in Woburn, as I mentioned last week. And, boy, what a great show that was. It's almost as if they knew I was coming by having a talk segment with my favorite wrestler in Chaotic, the retrosexual Anthony Green. I love that character. It's just so great. Where he cuts the hair of the owner of the promotion, Brian Fury, as part of that segment. Oh, did they know that I'm such a huge fan of haircut angles that, oh, just so happens, first show he's been to in months, we're going to do one of them. And I absolutely loved it. Main event with JT Dunn and Maxwell Jacob Friedman, who was a very impressive talent. And the fact that he's only 22 years old kind of blows my mind. It's another one of those deals where I look up his birthday on, like, March 15th, 1996. I'm like, holy crap. Like, that dude is young to the point where, like, I can remember stuff that I did that week in my life. It was actually the next day that I played my last youth hockey game that I ever played. And this is a tape I have to dub over because this tape exists and the GIF file will be priceless. I got thrown out of the game for fighting, and then I skated over to the door. And as my dad is filming it, I stop at the door, I turn around, I take off my glove and give one middle finger to everybody, and then I march off. So, anyway, back to the... I don't know when the Chaotic shows got so edgy. Not overly so, like, say, 1999 WWF, but it's certainly more edgy in terms of language than I remember it being in the past. It's not like, you know, a bunch of TNA is, you know, running around there. And I recall listening on the Wrestling Podcast About Nothing, which I do plug every week, and I listen to every week, the difference in shows that Chaotic runs in certain cities, it is kind of strange because the area in which they run, they probably don't run places that are more than 50 miles apart from each other, although they are doing a benefit show down in Rahway, New Jersey on WrestleMania weekend. The shows in Woburn are very different than the shows they go to in Lowell, and I never really thought about it until they brought that up, that... Yeah, you got different crowds there. It's probably the same in Jim Crockett Promotions back in the day, where, like, South Carolina would be different than North Carolina and Virginia and so on. But yeah, Woburn is different from Lowell in terms of the crowds. I've noticed that maybe I'm just biased because I grew up there, but I prefer the Woburn shows and the Woburn crowds in Lowell. It's a little bit more chill. For whatever reason, although I have not gone to as many shows up there, but I look for it. The next one is in a couple weeks, Cold Fury 18 in Lowell, so I'm hoping I'm able to get to that one, but this is one of those deals where I'm going to a lot of wrestling between now and the middle of April, where I gotta do some favors. Like, basically I have to build up capital with my wife to create that sort of goodwill so that I can go to these shows. Like, with WrestleMania, it's basically the clearing of the driveway of snow for every time there's been a storm for the last 8 or 9 years. That's the kind of goodwill that I had to build up over time. In terms of going to, like, Friday night show, it meant I had to make myself available on Saturday, and I told my other friends I was going to go out with them to Bone Up Brewing on Saturday in Everett. I'm like, well, can we go in the afternoon? I'm like, well, all right, I got to get home by 7 or else my wife's going to cut my balls off. So it's marriage is about managing everything, and I got to do what's best for business. I don't know where I've heard that phrase before, but the other good thing about the Chaotic show in Woburn was my pal, the voice of Greetings from Allentown, Keithy, was there, and it's always a joy when he's there, talking to him before the show, after show, during the intermission. Hell, he bought me a beer the second I walked into the venue, and he's like, well, I owe you for something. And I said, well, let's just say it's for promotional consideration. Sometimes things can get a little weird with him. Like, when I was talking to him, he's very excited about being able to host Easter for his family, mainly so that he can make his brother just sit there and stir the sauce all day because he's making 3 pounds of meatballs. I thought, feels awfully familiar when you're telling somebody to sit there and just kind of stir the sauce all day. I feel like I've seen that before. And then after the show, I'm talking to him in the parking lot saying our goodbyes. And he's, you know, he knows that I love baseball. So he, like, says, oh, yeah, there's a place just down the street that has got a bunch of cool baseball memorabilia. And he points me to it. And I start walking in that direction. and he's like doing that weird point, and I know I've definitely seen it somewhere.
No, no, right on there, right on the corner. Yeah, it's over there, right there.
I did start to get suspicious that he was pointing me towards some cool baseball memorabilia in East Woburn in the middle of winter and all that. So I yelled that I was in a hurry and that I had to get home and that my wife was watching the cat. Something like that. But I'm sorry, Keithy. I just got to say, that was a little strange of you to do that. Anyway, on to Pro Wrestling USA. As I said, it is a union of several wrestling promoters. And it's hard to get these assholes to agree on anything. So to get them to present a united front, even against a Vince McMahon who is threatening their very survival, was going to be particularly difficult, to the point where I don't think Vince McMahon was particularly worried about Pro Wrestling USA, other than the fact that, well, there was one hilarious thing that he did to kind of screw with them around the time that this would have aired. I kind of look at these wrestling promoters as sort of like the Muslim world a little bit, and sort of how, yes, they all kind of have various levels of dislike for Israel, so I guess the WWF would be Israel. But you have the Saudis, Iran, Iraq, who all sort of hate each other, Syria. They all have issues with each other, issues of trust, and they're never going to be able to ally in such a way that it would ever be 100% threatening. I know it's not a perfect analogy, but I do think that there are some similarities. Now that I think of it, it's probably because Vern Gagne had a fondness for dressing up white dudes in Arab chic outfits between Blackwell and Ken Patera that it kind of planted the seed in my head a couple weeks ago. So let's take stock of where the WWF is at this point in 1984. Yes, they had stolen a bunch of time slots across the country, chapter and verse. It would be too numerous to go through all the various examples. So I'll stick to a national perspective where they're all over the USA Network between TNT, All-American Wrestling, Primetime Wrestling is going to start up in a couple of months. On the weekend, they have the two TBS time slots on Saturday and Sunday, which, while it's not going as well as they would have hoped, it is certainly classified as an asset that they would cash in at a certain point. And even a couple of months before this, you have in July the MSG show, The Brawl to End It All, which aired on MTV. So that is another cable outlet. And I guess there was some infighting with USA not being very happy about how they had WWF on their airwaves and would kind of hope for some sort of exclusivity to be the cable network that has these shows. But now they're showing up on all these other cable outlets as well. So, but that all sort of got worked out because they kind of needed each other, much like Bobby said that the Rockers needed each other. Luckily, nobody got thrown through a plate glass window. Now, on the other side, your opposition, just kind of an overview of the characters behind Pro Wrestling USA. You have Vern Gagne. The AWA is bleeding guys, as everybody knows, even as this thing is beginning. You got Hogan and Dr. D and Gene Okerlund going out the door right at the beginning of 1984 or late 1983. Jesse Ventura is gone as of May or June, and he's certainly in the WWF by June. And Bobby Heenan is the guy who jumps right as September 84 dawns, although he was apparently the one guy who actually gave proper notice. I think his motivation for this is he could see that things were starting to slide, except for some positive signs that he had in his promotion, like the Road Warriors, who we're going to see on this show, to kind of bring his territory back on a par with the NWA. I could see the psychology behind that, but also to kind of remain relevant and part of the conversation, and certainly the AWA, just a year before this, was one of the most important territories that there was. You have Jim Crockett Jr., who his promotion is now gaining influence within the NWA because they have the world champ. After Starrcade 83, you had Ric Flair winning the title there. He pilfers Dusty Rhodes out of Florida. I forget the exact timing on that, but he's certainly in by the end of 1984 because he's main eventing Starrcade. So I think the timeline of that pretty much aligns with around when this show is. So as they go along in this alliance, Jim Crockett probably has less incentive to be allied with everybody else because he's consolidated enough strength where he might be able to try and take on Vince McMahon by himself. Now, is that folly? Yes, but that's because we have 2020 vision, and I'm not talking about John Stossel getting slapped to the head. So he's got a little bit less incentive, I think. His guys aren't really on this show. Yes, there is an NWA presence, but you don't see the guys from the Carolinas on this show specifically. There's also the two Jerrys from Memphis, Jerry Jarrett and Jerry Lawler, who get involved in what I think is an effort to raise the profile of Memphis within the wrestling scene to a level where I think it would be deserved, given how good Memphis was around this time. And perhaps to get Jerry Lawler that world title reign, even if it was just a brief win the title from Flair and then lose it back 3 weeks later, something like that. That being a part of this would increase the chances of that happening, and in turn would help the Memphis territory in the long run. And that first taping, as I said, is at the Mid-South Coliseum on September 18th. You also have the television aspect of this is very interesting to me because it is Eddie Einhorn, who was actually the owner of the Chicago White Sox at this time. He owned the team from 81 through, I didn't get the exact date of when he would have been out on that, but he bought the team with Jerry Reinsdorf at that time. He was also involved in television, founding the Sports Vision cable network that they started showing White Sox games on that pay channel. But he also had a connection to wrestling in that he was one of the part owners of the IWA in 1975, a promotion that was the first attempt, really, to kind of go national in the manner that Vince McMahon was doing at this point. So it's interesting that he comes around again. And he rounded up a syndication network that included WPIX in New York City, which is a channel that I got up here in Boston. At least during the 80s, by the time 1990 rolled around, the cable system dropped PIX in favor of TBS. But it was at a cost of about $8,000 to $8,500 a week. So that was kind of a pretty penny, about $440,000 a year. But with Eddie Einhorn's connections, he was able to get a lot of that covered by sponsors. So they had a good reach. When you look at this on paper, it does seem like they are a viable opposition to the WWF. Maybe going into the Northeast might have been folly, but they did put a little bit of thought into it, getting Sergeant Slaughter a couple of months after this point when he had left the WWF, and getting Bob Backlund, although might be a little bit of a flawed strategy when it comes to Bob, who does a series of interviews on the first couple of Pro Wrestling USA shows that are rather interesting for the time period. In addition to Backlund, you also have superstar Billy Graham, very familiar to the Northeast audience. He is actually on this show. I'm starting to call him the Bad Penny of Greetings from Allentown because he keeps coming around these last few episodes since number 100. The Road Warriors, who are the AWA World Tag Team Champions, are on the show, and also the tag team of Jerry Lawler and Tommy Rich. So Lawler, not a single in this one. Also, Masa Saito, another name familiar to WWF fans of a certain era. And the feature bout, which isn't really promoted as such, but Harley Race, and this kind of goes into Bob Geigel's and the St. Louis office's involvement in all of this. He's going to be taking on Dutch Mantel, so kind of an interesting matchup. And as I said, we're going to hear from Bob Backlund, and all I wrote for that is, oh boy. But I'm very excited about the original commercials. So without any further ado, this is episode 105. So in continuing my sports moments series, I joked the other day that this rumor about The Undertaker doing a podcast, I'm like, boy, I'm in deep shit if The Undertaker does a podcast where he just plays hockey and baseball clips with a little bit of wrestling sprinkled in between. So for episode 105, of course, I'll be taking stuff from the year 2005. So why don't I kick it off with this one?
Yoel Pinheiro's pitch to Rafael Palmeiro swung on, and this is a flare down the left field line. It's going to go into the corner, and a base hit for Rafael Palmeiro, scoring the runner, legging down to second base with a stand-up double. 3,000 hits for Rafael Palmeiro, joining Aaron Mays and Murray.
I have never used steroids, period.
Pardon me if I can't muster up the same outrage as everybody else over steroids in baseball. If I'm going to be outraged about something Rafael Palmeiro related, it's going to be that time he won the Gold Glove in 1999, despite only playing 28 games at first base. I mean, I'm not going to name an alternate who I think should have won, because I just think that if you play 28 games out of 162, that's probably not enough to win the award. But you ever notice with steroids in baseball how Red Sox and Yankees players never seem to get suspended for PEDs, but former Red Sox and Yankees, like, oh, I don't know, Robinson Cano, Manny Ramirez, they always seem to get suspended for PEDs. I don't quite understand. It seems like quite a coincidence. And before you bring up A-Rod, that was a personal favor done for Derek Jeter, who didn't want A-Rod around during his retirement tour.
It's in Revelations, people!
Baseball conspiracy theories, we'll be right back. Alright then, I've said my piece. At the very top of this video, before the show actually gets going, there's an ad for a college football game played on that weekend in 1984 between Pitt and East Carolina, and I could not help myself but to look up what happened in that one, and Pitt defeated East Carolina 17-10. The only person of note on Pitt were actually two guys, Craig Ironhead Hayward, who starred for the New Orleans Saints later in the decade and into the 90s. I know he was in Tecmo Bowl. So if you were in Tecmo Super Bowl, that is, I'll certainly remember you. And Bill Frelick was playing for Pitt in that game. He debuted in the NFL the following year and made the all-rookie team and was a really, really great offensive lineman for many years, especially as a run blocker, because it was a very different NFL back then when linemen were more valued for run blocking rather than pass blocking, because that's just the way it was. East Carolina finished with a record of 2-9 that year, and Pitt finished at 3-7-1, although they did beat Penn State in the rivalry game at the end of the year. The open on Pro Wrestling USA, and I played the theme at the top, very similar to Memphis with the wrestling statue guy as sort of the main focus and the only thing you really see. Of course, the Memphis song is a little bit better with the sort of Ric Flair sounding music. By the way, I usually don't comment on current product stuff, but holy crap, the beatdown of Ric Flair and Batista showing up on Raw, that was really something else. So our host of Pro Wrestling USA is Jack Reynolds, who we've met on a couple of occasions in the past with WWF programming. But here, he is a very interesting choice for the play-by-play guy for this program, because I don't believe he was working in any particular wrestling territory at the time. He was a broadcaster in the Cleveland area. But his backstory was he was in the IWA in 1975, so it's kind of that Eddie Einhorn connection again. I don't know if he had any, you know, say in having Jack Reynolds as the guy. But here's the interesting thing about this, and this goes back to my whole, oh yeah, Vince McMahon doesn't screw with people or anything like that, or he wasn't concerned about Pro Wrestling USA. And this goes into Jack Reynolds. They taped this show on September 18th in Memphis. Jack Reynolds shows up in the WWF working the Maple Leaf Wrestling and All-Star Wrestling tapings on September 24th in London, Ontario, less than a week after this. So by the time Pro Wrestling USA hits the air on the 29th of September, Jack Reynolds is already in the WWF. I don't believe he debuts until the October 6th edition, because he's definitely on the October 13th 84 edition of Maple Leaf, which I covered all the way back in episode 9. And that is definitely one that I encourage you to check out in the archives. It's something that I did before Pro Wrestling Only, but is certainly in the spirit of the kind of show that it would eventually become. So Vince just stole this guy for whatever reason. He shows up on Maple Leaf. And yeah, he probably did need another announcer, since I don't think he quite bought Gorilla Monsoon as the play-by-play guy for his other shows, that at least that Vince wasn't doing. But it's just so strange and whatever. The thing that makes it even weirder is that Lance Russell, who, because the show is in Memphis, he's there. They could use him as the play-by-play guy, but instead they use Jack Reynolds, and Lance Russell is the ring announcer for this entire show. And I think the reason for that has to be that they wanted a neutral person doing these shows. You didn't want David Crockett doing it because, oh, well, he might put over his own JCP guys at the expense of everybody else. You weren't going to have somebody from the AWA for the same reason. So I see him as kind of the neutral arbitrator of all this. But Jack Reynolds working solo for some of these matches, although he will eventually get some help on some of these telecasts, he kind of needs an Angelo Mosca there to help him out, at least from a humor perspective. And, you know, from my perspective, I mean, I want to be able to play clips and, you know, funny stuff and all that. And he starts by running down the show, and he says that who is going to be on. And he manages to say Jimmy Valiant would be on twice, even though Jimmy Valiant doesn't actually have a match. What Jimmy Valiant does have is a music video that is quite interesting. Now is the time where we're just going to get the weird stuff out of the way, which is the Bob Backlund promo, which, as I said, is a series of interviews that he was doing on these early Pro Wrestling USA shows where he is just deadly serious. And honestly, it is the closest thing to a shoot interview you would probably find on a wrestling program circa 1984. Now, Bob, he's being accorded a level of respect because they're calling him the World Heavyweight Champion based on how he lost the Iron Sheik. He didn't submit. The towel was thrown in on his behalf. But his name, they're not showing him much respect on the Chiron because they spelled his name Backland, like B-A-C-K-L-A-N-D instead of L-U-N-D. So, big oops there. It's only the second show. I can't remember if they misspelled it on the first show or not. But Backlund's tone in all of this, it does seem Bob could come off a little hockey player-ish, and I don't know if that goes back to his upbringing in Minnesota or if it was just his style or whatever, but he seems particularly robotic in this one.
Well, it's great to be here, and I want to thank all the people for all their letters. And, you know, I want to explain something to all the people out there, all my friends, because you're all my right behind me, I know it. I'm not here because of them taking the belt away from me. There's another reason. I'm here because they wanted me to lower my standards. I set my standards high so your children can have somebody in sports to look up to. And somebody that you can say to your son, listen to that man. That was one of my goals 3 years ago, to be a perfect example. And nobody's going to tell me to lower my standards or to do something that I can't be proud of, because I've got to live with myself. And all you people know what my motto is, to be a champion within yourself. And I'm not going to be a hypocrite either. I'm not going to go around telling your sons and daughters not to take a pill and sneak around the corner and do it myself. My standards are high, so yours can be a little bit higher. That's the reason I'm here. Because my morals were too high, and my standards were too high.
Now, I'm not sure what Backlund means. He could mean that he doesn't go to a strip mall in Florida to get his hand jobs, or it could be that he just simply did not want to turn heel in the WWF, which is the actual story of what happened. But also, there's an undercurrent of him complaining about the direction that the WWF was heading in, with more, you know, less on wrestling and more on physique and characters and that sort of thing. Because Backlund was really more about the actual wrestling. His character is just the All-American boy, which isn't even really much of a character at all. So he's here to be the alternative for the Northeast audience. And I respect that. And people still liked him to an extent. But Backlund fatigue was very real. Not to the Dave Meltzer and Meltzer reader levels of, oh, the most embarrassing promotional thing from 1982 was Bob Backlund as the world champion. Not anything like that. But his last few months with the WWF, from the point where he loses the title, he goes away for a while, he returns in March, he has a match on TV, and his last match is in August against Sal Palomo at the Philadelphia Spectrum. He had other matches with B. Brian Blair, you know, that probably doesn't help as well. So the way he was treated on the way out certainly cut him down several pegs, and didn't really help him going into the next thing that he was going to do, this Pro Wrestling USA thing, which he actually does address in his book, Backlund, From All-American Boy to Professional Wrestling's World Champion, came out about 3 or 4 years ago. He seemed very aware of what he was getting into with this Pro Wrestling USA. The Pro Wrestling USA promotion, which is comprised of an unstable alliance between the NWA and the AWA, had offered me steady work, but there was too much infighting between the promoters to allow it to be successful. Oh, no shit. Although some jointly promoted cards did get off the ground, the problem was that the promotion was comprised of two different competing groups, the NWA and the AWA, and neither one was going to permit its champion to be overshadowed by the others. There was no clear leadership in the group, and as a consequence, although the promotion showed promise, could have been successful if an effective leadership team had been established, that never happened. I don't think anyone realized at the time that their collective future depended on it. Well, yeah, if you're looking for Vern Gagne circa 1984 for your leadership of a group for survival, it's probably not going to work out all that well. And as I said, Jim Crockett Jr. probably doesn't need this group as much as they need them. And the Memphis guys, they were not in a real position to kind of take the lead on this entire thing. It was going to be either Vern or Crockett because they're the two main players, and it just wasn't going to work out, even though, like I said, on paper, in theory, this is something that could have worked. So why don't we get into the actual matches here? And we start with the Fabulous Ones, who are in Memphis at this point. Steve Kern and Stan Lane are taking on Phil Hickerson and the Spoiler. Lance Russell being the friggin' ring announcer and Jack Reynolds on play-by-play. I mean, what the fuck? I mean, seriously, could we have it a little bit more backwards? Yeah, I know. We got to have the neutral announcer, no matter how much of a downgrade that is. I mean, Jack Reynolds, he would have been perfectly fine as the ring announcer here and just put Lance on commentary by himself. And I would have enjoyed this a hell of a lot more. Now, the Fabulous Ones, they were an example of early use of music videos back in Memphis in 1982 as they were rolling them out. And they became pretty wildly popular as a result. In fact, the original plan was to build them up to be popular in the beginning and then have them turn on Jerry Lawler. But they became so popular that it wouldn't really make sense at that point to kind of betray that, and they just kind of kept going with the good thing that they had. They leave in 82 after a very successful run. They go to Southwest for much of 1983, and they turn up in the AWA here in 1984. They're actually about to leave because the issue they were having was with the Road Warriors, who didn't really want to sell for Steve Kern and Stan Lane, which is kind of an issue. And the Road Warriors, the thought was, well, they should lose the titles to the Fabulous Ones. Well, that didn't happen. So knowing that they were blocked from getting to the top of the tag team heap in the AWA, they left and went back to Memphis for a while. Hickerson is a guy that, for whatever reason, for all that he did in his career in the territories, I just think of P.Y. Chu Hai as the first thing, because while it's not quite as offensive as, oh, let's say, dressing up in blackface, the white guy playing the Asian guy is a little strange, even for 1989. And then we have the Spoiler, and I thought, very interesting that we would have him on this show, Don Jardine. And then I realized, Is it possible that there's a fake spoiler out there? Because the spoiler was the NWA National Champion, so basically the Georgia Champion, at the time that the WWF bought Georgia Championship Wrestling. So he's wrestling in the WWF, which is why I thought this might be a fake. And this spoiler appears to be Steve Schumann, who was also known as Lance Idol at various points. So definitely not the same spoiler that you're used to. And every time I think of the spoiler, I always wonder, like, what exactly is that character supposed to be? Yes, he's a masked guy. I always laugh, like, should he just be a guy who just spoils TV shows and movies for the audience? Like in 1980, he tells everybody that Luke's father is Darth Vader and just ruined the movie for everybody. I know there was one, actually, I think it was one of my last days at Barnes & Noble in Las Vegas. It was when they had the last episode of Friends on, and I wanted to do a fake spoiler, of all things, over the PA system. That's because the show aired 3 hours earlier on the East Coast, so I could have called up one of my friends, like, hey, what happened, or whatever. I never really cared about Friends, but I thought it would be funny to go over the PA and say that all of them died in a tragic car accident, except for Joey. Which I know is a horrible thing to say, but, you know, whatever. I really don't care. I didn't watch that show. The other thing you can call him, like, a spoiler on a car? Is he supposed to be that thing that you put over your trunk that I don't quite understand why people put, like, a giant picnic table-looking thing on the back of their Honda Civic? I mean, these little-ass cars that have these giant spoilers. Now, I don't know if there's anybody in the audience of this podcast who has something like that on their automobile, but for Christ's sakes, could you at least provide an explanation for me of what the hell the logic is? I mean, you're not in the Coca-Cola 600, for God's sakes. I don't get it at all. So anyway, Kern starts with the spoiler, reverses a corner-to-corner Irish whip, and scores with a hip toss. The spoiler, the actual real spoiler, not the fake spoiler, so I'm kind of going back and forth. I made this note before I thought to myself that this was a fake spoiler, was in the original Legion of Doom, which you associate with the Road Warriors as being an interchangeable name, and they were part of the group, but also in the Legion of Doom, which was taken from Super Friends, is Jake the Snake Roberts, King Kong Bundy, and the spoiler himself, and this was back in 1983 Georgia. When it comes to the Fabs, apparently Jack Reynolds gets them confused because he says that Kern and Lane look alike, which I don't understand. I mean, yeah, I guess they have a similar body type, and they both have blonde hair and black beards, or dark beards at the very least. I'm like, I don't know. I could pretty easily tell the difference, and it's not like the video quality on this is all that good. It is a welcome change from the dark, long dark hair, dark beard combo that is on 85% of all professional wrestlers these days. Kern had his babyface offense number 21 on your generic scale, and then both guys end up tagging out. So here comes Stan Lane, who blocks a Beal by Hickerson out of the corner and then gets one of his own, then locks in a top wrist lock, tags into Kern. Works over Hickerson for a bit, but the spoiler is able to tag back in, at which point he gets on the house mic and announces what is going to happen in the big custody battle cliffhanger at the start of season 2 in Webster. So I don't know if the Memphis audience really gives a shit about Webster, but he's just spoiled it for all of them. He slaps Kern and then runs out of the ring and goes around the corner. And when he gets back in, they run the ropes, and he's caught with a forearm. All four guys end up in the ring, and then it kind of calms down fairly quickly as they work the left leg of the spoiler, as Jack Reynolds lets us know that the ladies love Stan Lane and love Steve Kern. I would have to say that they're probably more partial to Stan Lane. It's just, I don't know if it's just because when I see Steve Kern, I see Skinner. Probably should watch more Fabulous Ones matches just to kind of wipe the image of Skinner out of my head when it comes to Steve Kern. And I guess, you know, Doink number 2 as well. Hickerson comes in, but he gets his left arm worked over, so they've shifted from leg work on the spoiler to arm work on Hickerson. And then they do the fake tag bit where they switch places without the referee acknowledging a tag. And they do that twice in a row, which is always a fun spot when a babyface team gets away with some mild cheating, because they could have tagged each other. They're just kind of making the point that, yeah, we can cheat if we want to. If it really comes down to it, we are willing to do whatever it is necessary. And a little bit of a Fargo strut on the apron by Stan Lane, which is funny because Jackie Fargo, the original Fabulous Ones, gave his endorsement to them early on, which might have been key in getting them over to the extent that they did in Memphis. Quick comeback by Hickerson and the Spoiler, but it is short-lived. All four back in the ring. The heels are thrown into each other on cross-corner whips, and then the Fabs finish this one off with a double DDT. Nobody could really do a DDT right before Jake kind of brought it to a national audience. We had the Piper one a week ago. That was a little strange. Jack Reynolds, having called wrestling before, he ain't seen nothing like this.
Oh, ho, ho. I gotta find out what that move was. There's a three count, and it's all over.
I'd like to think that Vince McMahon got word through his moles or whatever that there was a guy who didn't know what to call moves, and he was like, oh my god, I should bring this guy in as one of my B-show announcers. That sounds awesome. But good showing for the Fabulous Ones, and I know that if I watched a lot of Memphis 1982, and I've looked on YouTube for complete episodes from that year, and maybe I'm not looking hard enough, I don't know, but I think that anytime I see a Fabulous Ones match, I'm kind of going into, you know what, I think I'm going to enjoy this.
My calls are all private, Elko is my phone, it's private calls, the phone on my own.
The first of our many wonderful 1984 ads on this show for Private Call, which I don't understand how it's any different than getting a separate phone line from Ma Bell or whatever the hell you want to call it that time. Nice little jingle, but it reminds me of a time, and it was a couple years after this, actually probably more like 1989, where my sister got her own phone line in her room. And it's a curious story of why that happened. And it was because there was suspicion that my other sister had, quote, stolen the car to go to Bill and Bob's Roast Beef, which, in fact, she did. I didn't say anything because I'm not a rat. Are you listening, Keithy? Good. But my other sister, oh, she had no problem ratting her sister out. And as a reward for that, she ended up getting her own phone line. So snitches get new phone lines, I guess is the saying in my family. Ad for Mr. Goodbyes, which I was trying to figure out what exactly this was, because it does not appear to be a place that is still open. This show is actually off the WPIX feed, so you'd see a lot of New York and even down to like the Philadelphia area sort of stuff. It looks to be a catch-all discount store. Now, those of you in the Boston area, if you know, in southern New England, there was a chain called Building 19 that just had like a lot of random crap. I remember I bought like a Patriots AFC East Champion shirt from 2004 for like $2. I bought like two of them. I was like, well, you know, whatever. It's kind of like that. Also, a advertisement for Smithsonian Magazine. You don't see many of those for magazines these days. Like, remember when, like, Sports Illustrated used to have stuff like, yeah, they'll give you, like, the shoe phone or the phone that's shaped like a football? Always that sort of stuff. And this was a 60-second ad that I thought was strange at the end, because they'd say, call up this 800 number, and for some reason, if you're in the state of Nebraska, they gave you a completely different number. I thought that was a little weird. And then an ad for Ready Cut Carpets. Shit's home with me, because I did do that bit with my wife the other night where she's like, yeah, I'm looking to replace the living room carpet. I want you to look at a couple of the samples. And I thought, okay, well, good. She's picked out like four or five. And then that extends out into like 10 to 12. And it's like, after a while, like, all right, I know that we want to do like a Southwestern theme in the living room, which I know makes me sound like Roger Dorn from Major League and all that. However, I'm like looking at all these and they start to look the same. And again, you know, managing your marriage, you know, you have to look like you're giving a shit sometimes, even when you don't really give a shit.
And now, a closer look at the boogie-woogie man, handsome Jimmy Valiant.
Ain't never been there, they tell me it's nice.
So this is a music video for the boogie-woogie man, Jimmy Valiant, to set to Life's Been Good by Joe Walsh, that came out in 1978, because some members of the Eagles were actually interested in continuing to work during that long period between the Hotel California album and the long run. It was about a 3-year stretch that Joe Walsh kind of had a little bit of a singles run, if you will. So this video is kind of funny. Valiant, of course, very famous in JCP. His war with Paul Jones's army is well underway in 1984. I mean, hell, it dates back to Starrcade 83. But he's also a very well-known commodity in Memphis, having worked there quite a bit over the years. So just kind of introducing him, I guess, to that Northeast audience, or even though he probably needs no introduction for anybody who had been watching for a while, because he was a tag team champion in the WWF as recently as 5 years before. But okay, you kind of want to present this image. And I think the song is kind of an appropriate choice with, you know, some of the lyrics and the way that it feels. Stuff like the part where it's, they say I'm crazy, but I have a good time. I'm just looking for clues at the scene of the crime. Life's been good to me so far. I could picture Jimmy Valiant as sort of the character that Joe Walsh should be referring to, although certainly the song is not about him. So Jimmy is just sort of marching around. It's like on some sort of patio near a body of water. The motivation of where he is not made clear. However, it can't be that warm out because he's wearing a satin jacket that actually says Kiss on it. Now, I wouldn't have taken Valiant for being a Kiss fan. In fact, I'm not a fan of them at all. Every morning I get up and I put on my Sirius satellite radio when I get in my car to go to work, and I turn on channel 30 and I say, is this the day that they're going to get rid of Kiss radio off that channel? And the answer is no. The whole month of February, the answer has been no. I mean, they could just bring back the Billy Joel channel and make everybody happy, but no, we have to satisfy whatever's left of the Kiss army that's still out there. There seems to be showing a lot of women's asses walking around in bathing suits. Not a lot of frontal shots. It's almost like they totally didn't get permission from any of these people to use the footage. So you're just going to show their asses. Kind of like when you see on the news, like the quote-unquote headless fat people when they do a story on obesity, because you can't show their faces, but you just show them, like, from the neck down to demonstrate that, you know, somebody is heavy. They show him in front of a bunch of street signs. I don't know where that was. It could be a museum. It could be a TGI Fridays. We don't really know. Then they show a woman on the beach, and again, she's just, like, lying there getting a suntan, I think face down, and they clearly did not get permission to shoot this. And then at the very end, you get Jimmy Valiant in kind of that Vasco da Gama pose, that I like to call it. And then in cursive writing, it appears on the screen like almost like somebody signing it, the Jimmy the Boogie Woogie Man Valiant. And I think that is just wonderful. Now, Jimmy Valiant and Vasco da Gama, I don't know how much they have in common, but they are both known for their beards.
Podsednik hits one to deep right center field. Back at the wall. This ball is gone. Podsednik goes deep. His second home run of the postseason. And the White Sox win it 7-6.
This is going to sound like a very weird thing for me to say, but I've been waiting so long to talk about the 2005 Chicago White Sox because they are the most fascinating, possibly the most underrated championship team in any sport in North America in my lifetime. They go wire to wire in the regular season. Yeah, there have been other teams that have done that, 1990 Reds. But looking at this White Sox roster, there's not a lot that jumps out at you from the everyday lineup, save for Paul Konerko, who was an excellent player for a number of years, Jermaine Dye in right field. A lot of guys with OPS plus figures under 100, which, you know, kind of, I guess, would put them below the league average for that year. But fine. Even the bullpen, a lot of question. There's not a lot of high strikeout guys in that bullpen. However, they were not even needed at a certain point, because the thing that I love about that team is they go to the American League Championship Series against the Angels, because the Yankees lost to the Angels and didn't show up for their proper beating against the White Sox. Four complete games in five games, and the only time they went to the bullpen was in the ninth inning of Game 1 to get two outs. So one guy in their bullpen got into the Championship Series. They sweep the defending champion Red Sox, and they sweep the Astros in the World Series. A walk-off homer by Scott Putsednik, who, by the way, had zero home runs during the season. It's amazing how they would, you know, come through in situations like that. Usually I would hate a team, because I was cheering for the Red Sox, that would have beaten them in the playoffs, but I have to take my hat off to the Chicago White Sox of 2005, because there's another thing about them is Frank Thomas was there, but he got hurt, and he wasn't there on the postseason roster. So I say this from that perspective. Is there any championship team in North American sports that doesn't have a single Hall of Famer yet won the championship of that league? It's very hard to think of an example of that. You say, well, the 2003 Marlins, well, they had a very young Miguel Cabrera. So usually you look at all these rosters, even in the modern era where you got 30 teams where it might be more likely to happen. Maybe it'll be the case with the San Francisco Giants if Madison Baumgartner doesn't quite get the numbers to get in. But that White Sox team is just fascinating to me. I had thought about doing a podcast where I just cover certain teams that, you know, just talk about them for 20 to 30 minutes. And the 2005 White Sox would have been an inspiration for me to do something like that. And speaking of Chicago and guys who, if they're actually from the south side of Chicago, they would naturally be White Sox fans. The Road Warriors are up next, and they are taking on Keith Eric and Tracy Smothers. And I was so friggin' delighted to see a young, fresh-faced Tracy Smothers, who just turned 22 years old earlier in September of 1984. So the Warriors, they are the saving grace of the AWA in 1984. They are the rare big draw as a tag team. But eventually, they kind of fade away from the AWA over time because they spend more time in Japan. They dabble into Jim Crockett Promotions for a while, but they don't go full-time there until 1986. So this is something that Vern wasn't going to be able to keep under wraps forever. In fact, when you look back, it is kind of a wonder how he was able to hang on to them for as long as he did. Now, Jack Reynolds, I don't know what the hell's wrong with him. He calls them the Fabulous Road Warriors. Well, let me tell you something. If everybody is fabulous, then nobody is fabulous. Reynolds then shows just how plugged into this Pro Wrestling USA product he is by getting immediately contradicted by Lance Russell, the ring announcer.
This should be a one fall with a 30-minute time limit. By the way, precious Paul Ellering, their manager, also in attendance. Let's go up to the ring right now with the official announcement.
One fall, 15 minutes in time, this bout. One fall, 15 minutes in time.
So yeah, at this point, I just pray that something is going to happen to the commentary to make it bearable to get through the rest of the show. And by God, my prayers were answered in the best possible way.
You know, Jack, I can't tell them apart. They call them the Road Warriors and Animal and Hulk. One's got muscles and one's got more muscles. And they're getting right on top of this, these two other wrestlers. There you see press slams right there.
I don't know if somebody went into the bathroom at the Mid-South Coliseum and said Terry Funk's name into a mirror three times and summoned him to the commentary table to save us from the tyranny of Jack Reynolds. But the Funker, he was in his kind of famous 1983 retirement, at least as far as Terry Funk retirement goes, you know, because there's been, you know, a whole lot of them. It was a big deal made of that in Japan, and it lasted about a year. He comes back in October. And thank God he did come back, because a wrestler retiring in 1983 kind of feels like the wrong time, at least, you know, for your legacy. If Bob Backlund had, you know, kind of faded away after this Pro Wrestling USA run and didn't come back later on and have the run as the crazy heel, he certainly is remembered very differently. Think of all the Terry Funk things that happened after 1983, between his WWF run, him going into the NWA in 1989, challenging Flair, having that great feud with him, all the stuff through the 90s, basically building ECW in part on his back. It's funny because the first match that Terry Funk has on record when he comes back in October is teaming with his brother Dory to face the Road Warriors. I find that kind of funny, almost like it's this scouting mission or something like that. So the Road Warriors, they handle Keith Eric for a little bit, and he tags out to Smothers. And Hawk is in there with the back elbow, and then he throws a gut-wrench suplex, which I was very shocked to see. I was like, I don't remember Hawk bringing out a wrestling move like that. So Funk asked Paul Ellering, who has put on a headset and is now joining the commentary, why Hawk can't do that more, meaning like actual wrestling moves. And Paul says that their guys are the kings of pain. Well, I guess they're not authors yet, because, you know, they're not quite as learned as Occam and Razor or whatever their names are. So Tracy is then tossed back to Keith Eric. So they're going to let them have a couple tags. I know I had my theory of jobber tag teams where the true jobber teams are only allowed one tag. But instead, we're going to get Keith Eric back in there. And Hawk just kind of chokes him on the mat and is doing the Andre the Giant 1989 thing where he breaks on the 4.5 count and then goes right back to it. And when he's had enough of that, he tosses him back to tag Tracy Smothers back into the ring. And an Irish whip, Animal, is in there and gets a bear hug off the Irish whip. And Keith Eric comes in, tries to break up the bear hug, and he's like trying to like jump. It's almost like he's trying to jump to reach something on a shelf and he can't quite get there. Really kind of a pathetic attempt. But it also looked badass on the part of the Road Warriors where, yeah, a second guy comes in and tries to break something up and it's just sort of shrugged off. All four end up in the ring and Tracy is basically friggin' decapitated on a regular clothesline by Animal. And that is how the Road Warriors pick up the win. No doomsday device or any of that stuff, but plenty of cool, badass work here from the Warriors. The shrugging off of it, I absolutely love that part of it. The only missing component to this match, in my opinion, is that Road Warrior pop. They're still very new, and they are heels, and new to this territory in Memphis. This crowd probably does not know them quite as well. And if you do this a year from now, I think the reaction to it changes. And I mean, their run is extremely strong all through the rest of the decade of the 1980s. And if you really want to go in depth on that sort of thing, I advise you to check out ProWrestlingOnly.com, where you can explore other podcasts, along with match reviews, features, and retrospectives, reviews of wrestling books, video games, matches, playlists, wrestler appearances in non-wrestling TV shows, movies, and more. Join the conversation by signing up at the Pro Wrestling Only forums, online for over a decade, with over 2,000 registered members and an archive of a hell of a lot of threads. Message board is a vibrant community, whether you want to talk about a specific match in the match discussion archive, take a deep dive in the microscope form, or discuss more general topics from wrestling's past and present. Check all of that out and more at ProWrestlingOnly.com.
Too bad for you. Your ex has someone new. WPIX 102. Too bad for you.
Too bad for you.
I have somebody who keeps singing me love songs.
Nothing but love songs.
It's an ad for the radio station in New York, WPIX 102 FM, which is actually now 101.9, The Fan, WFAN. Looking into that station's history, they change formats like normal people change their socks it seems. So that love song format that they kept through 85 and then they went to a hot adult contemporary, whatever the hell that means. The ad itself, it has like animations, which feels like I'm hallucinating watching it. I didn't quite understand what vibe they were getting at there. Got an ad for Tennis Magazine, and I have to say that tennis felt a lot bigger in the 1980s. I don't know if it's because there were more Americans or if it was just the sports landscape, and I have no idea why it faded away so much. I think some of it has to do with the lack of Americans. I'm talking about in this country. There's not a lot of dynamic guys who have come along. There was hope for Andy Roddick, but quite frankly, I don't think he turned out the way everybody thought. Anyway, with the word tennis, okay, T-E-N-N-I-S, I'm rather fascinated by this thing that in recent years, there have been two athletes named Tyler Ennis, one of them in the NBA and one of them in the NHL. And I find it fascinating that there would be two guys with a name as unique as Tyler Ennis. And I only mention that because it's T.Ennis. Anyway, and then there's an ad for this movie, Running Scared, which is not to be confused with the Billy Crystal movie that came out 2 years later. It's very unclear what they were trying to tell us what this was. It was like silhouettes of people saying some kind of spooky stuff. So we go to now an interview segment with Jack Reynolds, and I can assure you that this is probably just wonderful. And the Rock and Roll Express are there, and they had the first match on the first show. So if you want to have that as a trivia question, who won the first match that aired on Pro Wrestling USA, it would be the Rock and Rolls, except they only showed the finish of that match, which is kind of a peculiar way of kicking off the program. Rock and Rolls are very excited about their upcoming foray into the Northeast with Pro Wrestling USA. Unfortunately, though, we're going to have to deal with the fact that they're going to let Robert Gibson talk for 7 seconds.
Hey, Ken, the Rock and Roll Express, it's been a long time. We're looking forward to coming down there to the East and do a little rock and rolling down there, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean, Robert. There's plenty of fresh tail in Jersey for you guys to conquer. I mean, you know, there's plenty of rats in the state of New Jersey. Am I right? High five.
That's right, Jack. You know, we were a pleasure to be associated with Pro Wrestling USA, and we're looking forward to coming to the East, brother, because you might have heard about the Rock and Roll Express, but you hadn't seen us yet, and we're going to come rocking. We got a lot of things we can do. We're one of the fastest teams there is around today, and baby, we're one of the quickest, and we could beat you, we could put you down on the mat. We're looking forward to coming to the East. Woo! Huey Lewis, the heart of rock and roll.
Why not get the shout-out to Huey Lewis there at the end? Although maybe it's because Huey was, in fact, the first sports entertainer. The very interesting thing about the Rock and Rolls being at this Pro Wrestling USA taping is that literally the day before, on the 17th, they had lost a Loser Leave Town match to the Nightmares, who are one of the teams that they end up facing. And in fact, it's the end of the match that they show on the first episode of Pro Wrestling USA. Kind of weird that way. But to have them under that umbrella, it is something, if you're going to compare it team for team with the WWF, they didn't really have in the New York territory a team quite like the Rock and Rolls, and they wouldn't for quite some time. I'd say that it's not until the Can-Am Connection comes along at the end of 1986 where you have this pretty boy tag team who are really good workers who get the women all excited about them.
Randy Hunt with Drew Remenda. We can now confirm the San Jose Sharks arguably have just made the biggest trade in their history. The Sharks have another Thornton. Joe Thornton from the Boston Bruins comes to the Sharks in exchange for Marco Sturm, Wayne Primo, and Brad Stewart. Rarely do you see a three-for-one trade, but rarely does a player of Joe Thornton's status move. So Joe Thornton is a San Jose Shark as of tonight. Your thoughts?
Oh, I'll give you my thoughts. When I saw the headline on ESPN at the time, I remember thinking, this is strange. Why are the Bruins trading for Scott Thornton from the Sharks? See, I had it backwards because I thought, well, it would be insanely idiotic to trade your franchise center at the end of November when he has 2 years left on his contract, which, granted, a no-trade clause was going to kick in, but that wouldn't be until July 1st. So you had plenty of time to deal with it at a later date. But instead, oh no, let's just panic and dump him for three guys from San Jose, only one of whom panned out in the least. although they salvaged it by trading Stewart and Primo later on for Andrew Ferentz and Chuck Kobosu. I have an Andrew Ferentz stick behind me as I record this. But anyway, for the reasons why I'm mad as hell about the trade, you trade your franchise center and you don't even get any draft picks back. You wait until the trade deadline at the very least, and you get a bunch of teams bidding. But no, the idiot Mike O'Connell just decides, you know what, I'm going to trade him right now because the Bruins had lost like 9 out of 10, and San Jose had also lost 9 out of 10. The difference is San Jose went on an incredible run. Joe Thornton won MVP of the league that year, the only guy traded midseason who went on to win the MVP. And it's just insane. I was so angry about it at the time that I just turned off on the Bruins for the rest of the year. I didn't have season tickets at that time. At the end of the day, it worked out because it provided them room in a leadership vacuum that made it attractive for Zdeno Chara to come in and have it be his team. But God, it just pisses me off so much in retrospect. That was not a good week for me because I the night that it happened, my father was basically dying on the couch. He passed away 4 days after this, so a lot of my anger and sadness about that was transferred over into this trade that had occurred of my favorite player to San Jose, where he still plays to this day. And in fact, his San Jose Sharks that came into Boston tonight as I record this and lost 4-1 for the Bruins. So I don't know. I like Joe Thornton because I don't know. I have a connection for whatever reason with athletes who were born in 1979. There's not too many of them left. Roberto Luongo, Drew Brees, Adrian Beltre just retired. So, you know, quite frankly, I am starting to feel old. And so you get back to talking about wrestling, Pete. And I would, except for the fact that coming up next, we have superstar Billy Graham, the Bad Penny of Greetings from Allentown, who just keeps coming back again and again. And there's nothing remotely interesting about him compared with the last two times that we've seen him, other than the fact that he's randomly with Jimmy Hart, which is an odd combination to think about. But Jimmy is there because he's working in Memphis. He's the top manager there, as he had been for many years. And they just sort of paired him with heels to kind of say, okay, you should boo these guys. It's a pretty simple way of doing things for a crowd that may not be as familiar. I actually wondered if Graham was in Jim Crockett Promotions at this time, but he's actually up from Championship Wrestling from Florida. And their involvement in Pro Wrestling USA doesn't really get mentioned with the other promotions quite as much, but they obviously had good reason to be in league with the rest of them. And Graham is there because he's an East Coast name that people know. He's a WWWF champion. I'm very fond of saying WWWF champion because I always have to think in my head so I don't say the W like 5 or 6 times. You know, I have to put on the brakes so I don't like crash into the proverbial wall. He does turn up in Crockett around Christmas time like a lump of coal, except coal is generally a better worker in the ring because it actually, you know, will provide energy.
About introducing at 229 pounds, Ken Raper. Ken Raper.
I'm afraid to say anything, but as we'll see a little bit later on, he's not the most unfortunately named thing on the show. Seeing Jimmy Hart with superstar Billy Graham does seem a little weird, but then you realize, oh yeah, Jimmy's got to get practice in if he wants to manage Dino Bravo in 1990. That seems to be the most apt comparison I could think of in his future. He's very chatty with the fans, Graham is. He's picking on one guy, and he dominates early, but with as little movement as humanly possible. Terry Funk says that he's showing Raper who's the boss, and oh my God, I'm going to lose my friggin' mind. Superstar is a one-man gang, is what Reynolds says. You know, I can't do this anymore. I can't talk about any more Superstar Billy Graham matches from 1984 and 85. So that's it. I'm just going to read song lyrics because it is far more entertaining than talking about this guy. Yeah, he picks up the win with the full Nelson. But in lieu of actually giving you a rundown of the match, I am going to read some lyrics from the song Freak Like Me by Idina Howard, released in January of 1995. Let me lay it on the line. I got a little freakiness inside, and you know that the man has got to deal with it. I don't care what they say. I'm not about to pay nobody's way, because it's all about the dog in me. Mm-hmm. I want a freak in the morning, a freak in the evening, just like me. I need a roughneck brother that can satisfy just for me. If you are that kind of man, because I'm that kind of girl. I got a freaky secret everybody sing, because we don't give a damn about a thing. Because I will be a freak until the day, until the dawn. And we can pump, pump all through the night till the early morn. Come on and I will take you around the hood on a gangsta lean. Because we can pump, pump any time of day. It's all good for me. So yeah, this is far more interesting to me than superstar Billy Graham in 84 and 85. He needs to just get out of my life. This is not a positive relationship for me. It is making me not want to watch any more of this stuff.
It was Colvin who stripped it, Vrabel who landed on it, but he would have had the first anyway. First down, and Brady threatening to go long, and indeed launches it for Branch, has it at the 10 and in the end zone. Touchdown, New England.
What a throw by Tom Brady. And he took his time. He was patient. The protection was there. He laid it out, and Deion Branch did not panic. He kept his arms down, and he ran through the football.
Yeah, I could have put in something from Super Bowl 39 where the Patriots defeated the Philadelphia Eagles. Yeah, remember that? The Patriots did beat the Eagles in a Super Bowl. But I don't want to antagonize the Philadelphia listenership to this program, of which I believe is pretty outsized. So, you know, I'm going to take it easy on that front. Because the AFC Championship game that year against Pittsburgh, he goes into Pittsburgh with a 103-degree fever, which, of course, gets forgotten. I mean, Michael Jordan gets the flu once, and we get to talk about it forever. But Tom Brady, 103-degree fever, oh, we're just not going to talk about it anymore because he's just going to continue to amaze us for the next 15 or so years. Story. New England quarterback Tom Brady had a 103-degree fever the night before the Patriots beat the Pittsburgh Steelers in the AFC Championship game, Sports Illustrated reported. The magazine said in this week's issue that Brady had an intravenous line in his left non-throwing arm on Saturday night while fighting off chills in his Pittsburgh hotel room. In outdoor temperatures of 11 degrees, Brady threw for 2 touchdowns and no interceptions to lead the Patriots to a 41-27 victory in their third Super Bowl appearance in 4 years. I don't know his complete family tree or anything, but I assume that Tom Brady is related in some way to the Rooney family because he definitely has an ownership interest in the Pittsburgh Steelers. In fact, I think he's owned them for about 16, 17 years, something like that. I also don't want to forget about the commercials that are airing on the show, such as one for Coleco. There's a product of the 1980s for sure. The Adam Family Computer System. And apparently, if you buy one, you'll get a $500 scholarship for your kid, so the computer will help them get to college, and they'll also chip in a little to pay for it. Now, $500 is kind of a thanks for nothing once you get to, like, the late 90s. I mean, even in the early 90s, you're talking, like, in private schools, at least 20 grand a year, so it's not really making much of a dent. But I'm more concerned about the other commercial, which is for a variety show that aired across the country in syndication, but was, I believe, based in New York from Dick Clark Productions.
Hi, I'm Alan Foster, and I'm the host of Quitting on the Hit. It's a brand-new lip-sync contest that's packed with the best in pop music, laughs, surprises, and special guest celebrities. Quitting on the Hit is fun for everyone, so join me and a whole bunch of talented people each week as they compete for prize money worth up to $25,000. It's a show that makes you the star you've always wanted to be. That's Quitting on the Hit.
So that show lasted about 4 years in the mid to late 80s, and the whole concept was you would come on there and you would lip sync these songs, but you would get dressed up in costumes. A lot of people, unfortunately, dressed up in blackface, so that probably does not bode well for their future because the tapes are probably out there. And they would actually come, I think, to towns and have like these sort of localized putting on the hits contests and stuff like that to kind of promote the show. It's pretty ingenious. I don't want to say it's sort of like reality television, but it's a lot like The Voice and all that other stuff now, except that the people are actually lip-syncing. But this guy who was reading the ad, Alan Fawcett, who kind of looks like the love child of Dave Meltzer and Willie Ames, because he's got that mop of hair up there. And I looked into him, and there was a little incident that he was involved in that, the funniest thing about it is the citation for the story where I found it, it was probably Wikipedia, is an Arsenio Hall monologue from June 15th, 1989. So I click on the thing, as I always do when I go down that rabbit hole, and I'm sitting through the Arsenio Hall monologue from that date, and sure enough, he brings up the news story involving Alan Fawcett, and this is going to wow your balls off when I tell you this. A story from the LA Times, August 3rd, 1989. The 42-year-old former host and writer in the nationally syndicated television show Putting on the Hits was sentenced to 3 years of probation for sexually molesting a 24-year-old woman he met at a restaurant. As a condition of probation, Harry Alan Fawcett of Sherman Oaks will be required to participate in a substance abuse counseling program to help him with his drug and alcohol addictions. Under a plea agreement, Fawcett pleaded no contest in municipal court on June 14th to an amended count of sexual battery for forcing the woman to orally copulate him in his apartment last February. He originally was charged with 4 felony sexual assault charges. So that was what Arsenio was actually referring to from the monologue on June 15th. According to court documents, Fawcett was high on cocaine and alcohol at the time of the incident. Believed the woman who had a sexual encounter with Fawcett 4 years ago was a willing partner. The woman admitted she had inhaled cocaine before the sexual activity began, court documents said. So yeah, that's not good. And in fact, it says that they met at Tony Roma's. I don't know why that detail amuses me so much. Probably because I spent so much time in the old Binion's Horseshoe in downtown Las Vegas, where you're just trying to play blackjack on the damn, you know, or video poker or something, and it's just a constant stream of announcements. Blah, 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 your table for two is available at Tony Roma's. Presley, party of four, your table is available at Tony Roma's. It's just an endless stream of telling people that their table is ready at Tony Roma's. The dude only got probation for it. He should feel quite fortunate for that. Turn I Hear on the Dark Side by John Cafferty and the Beaver Brown Band, portraying Eddie and the Cruisers from the movie of the same name. You can tell he's exactly channeling Bruce Springsteen with that song, because I know how Springsteen songs are arranged with the dun 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 dun, and then you get the big sax solo. It's exactly how that song is arranged. So when I was much younger, I was like, is this actually Springsteen? Is some weird unreleased thing? Because I never saw Eddie and the Cruisers on cable, which is where it became a mild big deal after it wasn't really a hit in the theaters. It ends up on cable in 84, and now all of a sudden the song becomes a hit. Very strange. So Jerry Lawler and Tommy Rich are paired as one here. Saw them as enemies in 1987 Memphis a few weeks back. I like to think of them as the Memphis, Georgia connection, because Tommy Rich, the biggest babyface in Georgia in the early 80s, and Lawler, of course, is the king of Memphis. Rich's career in Georgia Championship Wrestling takes a slight turn as you get into 1984, because it was on Christmas night, 83, loses the Loser Leave Town match to Ted DiBiase, and then does a brief run for several weeks as Mr. R, stop me if you've heard that before, under a mask. But eventually he does leave Georgia in February and turns up in Memphis, where he stays for much of the year. And it's kind of funny, when he does go back to Georgia eventually later in the year, think of how everything has changed from Vince McMahon buying the territory. They lose the TBS time slot, and they end up back on TBS, but in a worse morning time slot. And it's the Ole Anderson Championship Wrestling from Georgia. I should probably do one of those episodes if I think about it at some point. So Lawler and Rich, for better or worse, they are a tag team. So they are asked about this new hot team, the Road Warriors, that we just saw.
Well, Jack, You know, I've been watching the monitor in the back, and I've seen these guys on several of these tapes. Without a doubt, you know, they're big, they're impressive, they're tough. But at the same time, you know, they abuse their opponents. They're in there with a lot of these guys that they could, you know, probably beat within a few seconds. But they seem, you know, they seem intent on inflicting a lot of punishment on these guys. I'm just looking forward to seeing them against some a little more worthy opponents. So, like, possibly Tommy and myself. I think we'd be able to give these guys a little better match. What do you think, Tommy?
Yes, sir. You know, it'd be my pleasure. You know, I'm looking forward to coming to New York and the whole wrestling area up there. Jerry Lawler and myself, we go way back, and I think we'd make a heck of a team to take on the Road Warriors.
Well, it might have been interesting if it had actually happened, but that didn't really seem to lead anywhere. But it was a natural talking point, given that we just saw them. They are taking on Lawler and Rich, the Nightmares, who were on, as I said, all three of the Pro Wrestling USA shows that are taped in Memphis. This is Danny Davis, not Dangerous Danny Davis. This is the OVW Danny Davis, along with Ken Wayne, another OVW bigwig of later vintage. And as we start this match in kind of a refreshing change, I don't know if Jack Reynolds had to take a whiz or if it took him a while to get back to the desk, but Terry Funk does the play-by-play at the very beginning, which is refreshing and also a little weird at the same time. And I should read Terry Funk's, from his book, his thoughts on the Pro Wrestling USA promotion, because if there's anything, you know, Terry Funk in his book is certainly a realist. And that's what I like about it is he doesn't have the same delusions that other guys have. There's not a lot of, well, I was supposed to get this title or this would have worked if it wasn't for this. Stuff like that. So Terry actually did briefly address this whole Pro Wrestling USA stint. In retaliation for Vince's expansion into his area, Vern Gagne tried promoting in the Northeast, Vince's stronghold, under the guise of working a cooperative deal with Alliance members in opposition to the WWF. But it was an unworkable approach because someone was going to have to be boss and those old promoters couldn't agree on who that would be. Junior and I even worked a couple of shows for the group, he means Dory, which is called Pro Wrestling USA, but we knew it wouldn't last. Vince went about it the right way, but the main thing he had going for him that Eddie Einhorn didn't was that Vince was willing to risk all the money he had on it. Vince backed up his plan with big bucks, paying the wrestlers more than they could make in their territories. And once he started to roll, it was over and no one could catch him, although it took some of the other promoters years to figure that out. Now, Terry Funk didn't get to become the Oracle of Wrestling for nothing. I mean, the man knows of what he speaks, and he's seen it all, and he's done it all. Lawler is in to start at right hands, not a whole lot to speak of. However, on commentary, a very interesting divergence as they talk about the movie Paradise Alley, which Terry Funk appeared in back in 1978, and this is entirely random even for me. You know, from that movie, you have Lee Canalito in it. And, yeah, we get some hot Lee Canalito talk.
Professional wrestling movies, or a movie that dealt with professional wrestling, was Paradise Alley, in which you co-starred the movie with Sylvester Stallone, Armand DeSante, and also Lee Canalito. Whatever happened to Lee Canalito?
Lee went ahead and started to play in that one movie, which I thought was a great movie. It was called Tarzan Movie with Bo Derek. And he got fired before that thing ended, too. So Lee's film career is about like mine.
Well, he had somewhat of a boxing career going, but nothing to do it.
He had about 15 straight fights, and he won every one of them.
The amazing thing about all that is it was 100% accurate. Yes, he was supposed to be in Tarzan with Bo Derek, and he ended up getting fired. Yes, he was a heavyweight boxer and won all of his fights. In fact, he retired undefeated. Of course, not quite to the level of Rocky Marciano, 49-0, heavyweight champion and all that. I believe he ended up 22-0, but he could have only had 15 fights up to that point because it was 1977 to 87, which was the span of his career. Oddly enough, that is the exact period that George Foreman was out of the heavyweight title picture. Anyway, that's really more of a coincidence. I'm kind of shocked at how heatless this match is because it's Jerry Lawler and Tommy Rich involved and we're in Memphis. But it is a different look for the Mid-South Coliseum. Maybe the people just aren't used to what they're seeing. Terry puts over Jerry Lawler's punch and he would know because they had the famous empty arena match in 1981. Certainly very memorable. I love the beginning of that where Lance Russell is waiting for them to arrive and he's smoking a nail on camera, you know, just kind of driving home the tension that is going on there. So Lawler and the Nightmares actually do an odd spot where Lawler runs the ropes between the Nightmares. They go back and forth. The guy on the apron actually does it as well. And I don't quite understand this, but Lawler hits one of them with a boot, but fine. Lawler ends up in trouble but reverses a corner whip, and then we get one of the slowest flare flops in the corner by one of the Nightmares. I can't really tell the difference between the two of them. I kind of sound like Jack Reynolds with the Fabs, but at least these guys are masked. I mean, and kind of look the same. So there is that. The flare flop, a.k.a. the Ray Stevens bump. I'm never quite sure how to attribute that. And the other Nightmare comes down, checks on him on the floor, and they actually walk around ringside to their own corner, and they tag out. They tag immediately. And I used to always think as a kid, why don't more tag teams do that, where they go around the outside of the ring? It's kind of like when you punt in football, the gunner running down to make the tackle if he runs out of bounds to kind of evade blockers. Of course, the problem with that is he can't touch the ball and down it, because then it's an illegal touching penalty. That's two illegal touching references in back-to-back weeks, I think. So, I always wondered why that wasn't done more. But we do get to see something that you'd see all the time on WWF programming, the Bret Hart Memorial knee to the back on Tommy Rich to help the Nightmares gain control.
He's not fucking dead.
Sorry, I always forget that. Clothesline, double axe handle off the second rope, so they're working over Rich pretty good here. But then one of the Nightmares, he puts his head down, a cardinal mistake for a ring veteran who's going to run a developmental territory someday. And the hot tag to Jerry Lawler. And I gotta say, the crowd just is crazy muted on this. I don't know if they didn't mic the crowd, but just kind of looking at them in the background, you'd think they'd be a little bit more wild for this tag team. But, whatever. A pile driver finishes off here, and I thought to myself, wait, now isn't the pile driver technically illegal? The referee had his back turned as Lawler was going for the pile driver, but he turned around and actually saw it as it was being delivered. But the way you could justify it, even if it was or it wasn't, and I don't know the exact timeline of the legality, that is illegal in Jarrett's promotion only, but not in Pro Wrestling USA. So that's the distinction that I'm trying to make. And this was a rather dull match, honestly. It left me a little disappointed. So to kind of cheer me up at the end, we get another Jack Reynolds gaffe on commentary.
The winners of the fall and the match, Tommy Lawler, the King, and Tommy Wildfire Rich.
I can assure you that it was definitely Jerry the King Lawler in this match, and it wasn't Filthy Tom Lawler, who used some sort of MLW-provided time machine to travel back in time and work the Pro Wrestling USA show. Although that would explain why the crowd is so muted, I think. We go to the ad break, and there is a creepy dude in glasses telling us to buy the Wall Street Journal. No thank you. Look a little too much like Stephen Collins for my taste, and I know what happened to him. It's almost as bad as that putting on the hits guy from earlier. Doan's pills for your backache, which I don't think I've ever taken Doan's, but luckily I've been able to avoid most back pain, at least since I worked at PetSmart, because lifting those 50-pound bags of dog food weren't the greatest thing in the world. That's why I preferred powerbombing those 8-pound bags and pretending that they were Rey Mysterio Jr. and just sort of lawn darting it into the wall or whatever.
Now you can compete in the Olympics too.
There's that!
Play McDonald's. When the U.S. wins, you win Olympic Games and win up to $10,000 instantly. Or keep your cards, and when the U.S. wins your event, you win a Big Mac, regular fries, or a Coca-Cola. So go to McDonald's and get your game cards today, because when the U.S. wins, you win.
I can't understand.
Dad, what? I thought he was at work. So did I.
Bad year for McDonald's in 1984. There was a mass shooting at one in the San Diego area in July. And then you had that Olympic thing where the Soviets and other members of the communist bloc boycott the Olympics, so that leads the U.S. winning all these events that they ordinarily would have won. So McDonald's has to pay out all this stuff from this contest that they had devised that I guess it promoted the brand because it got people going to McDonald's, but cost them a ton of money to actually do that. It's famously parodied on The Simpsons with the Krusty Burger chain with Krusty the Clown. And then, of course, there, as wrestling fans, the McDonald's incident of 1984, you know best as Ken Patera and Mr. Saito. But I was reading about that, and I knew that Saito wasn't actually at the McDonald's, and we see him up next with Jimmy Hart being interviewed at ringside. And the more I read about this, the more I start to feel that maybe Ken Patera did get railroaded in this whole thing. And you got to read a few more perspectives on it. And yeah, Patera, that is what he contends, that a kid came along and threw a rock through a window, which I can completely see. By the way, that McDonald's in Waskega or wherever it is, Wisconsin, is actually still there. The reason why Saito didn't go with him is he walked from the hotel a couple of blocks, and Saito didn't go because he had hurt his knee in a match either the day before or that night, and they had traveled to the town, got in late. But yeah, I could see why Saito was pissed, you know, when Patera didn't come back. I mean, he was hungry. I mean, you're not your usual Mr. Saito when you're hungry. Actually, that is exactly Mr. Saito when he's hungry, just kicking ass and taking names. So he's with Jimmy Hart because he's a heel, and we've got to establish him as such. And like I said, Jimmy Hart in Memphis to manage all the heels. That's not a particularly bad decision.
You know, Jack, last week we put up a challenge match to any professional wrestler that would like to crawl in the ring with Mr. Saito. We put up 1 million yen. Well, I tell you what, nobody's called. My phone hadn't been ringing off the wall because everybody evidently is scared of this man. So I'm going to up it. 40 million yen for any professional wrestler or anybody that can crawl in the ring with this man and defeat him. What do you say, Mr. Saito?
That's right. Everybody knows I'm a strong man. Now, I'm looking for tough competition. I'm looking for strong wrestlers because I'm the best. I'm the best of Japanese. After I find that. I find that American strong wrestler. Maybe Tennessee, maybe New York. Who is it? I'm looking for. Because I'm torture. That's my nickname. I told him. Nobody told him.
Ichiban, Mr. Saito. Number one,
Japan. Well, geez, no wonder why nobody took him up on it, because I took the liberty of going back to find out the exchange rate and what 1 million yen was in U.S. dollars at this point in 1984. And the exchange rate was hovering in the mid-240s. It was very different back then because it's about 110 yen to a dollar these days. And it was about $4,065. Not really enough to, you know, get me in the face of Mr. Saito. So by raising it to 40 million yen, now it's $162,600. So in 1984, I think that's enough to get somebody's attention. And Saito is up next. He's taking on Craig Carson, an enhancement talent who doesn't have a cage match link. So he's the purest of the jobbers. And I don't recall this guy working any WWF matches, which makes sense because there's no way a guy named Carson could work for a guy named McMahon. It just doesn't work. It would screw with my head. I love that Johnny Carson book that came out 5 years ago that was written by Henry Bushkin, his right-hand man, simply for, like, the Carson and Ed McMahon stories where, like, they had a system worked out where if Carson wanted to, you know, bang some broad or whatever, he was just done for the night. And Ed McMahon's kind of, you know, a hanger-on, so he's there. His signal to Ed to just go away and turn in for the night is like, so we all set here, Ed? And then McMahon would be like, yes, sir, oh, great one. And then he would go upstairs to his room. Oh, so great. Terry Funk kind of digs the abilities of Craig Carson, so we shall see what, if anything, he ends up bringing to the table. And Saito, who is completely no-nonsense, starts out with some arm work, and they call it a Japanese arm bar, but we know it now more as a Fujiwara arm bar. It's almost like he's working one of those WrestleMania 2000 matches on the Nintendo 64 where you just do the Fujiwara arm bar like 21 times, and he ends up pulling Carson's hair for whatever reason and then breaks the hold, goes for a takedown, gets that, and now just beats the shit out of him for a little bit because he's Mr. Torture. That's what he does. Carson actually gets a few shots in, but then he is hit with a sidekick that is way more vicious than any of the punches that he was throwing. And this blows my mind. It sets him up for his finishing hold for this bout, the friggin' sharpshooter. Yes. Mr. Saito locks in a pretty good sharpshooter, certainly better than The Rock. It's not quite to Hart family levels, but I'm not going to tell Mr. Saito that his sharpshooter isn't any good. And as I'm delighted by all the goings on here, we get yet another Jack Reynolds post-match gaffe.
Good body slam in there by Saito. Call it, Dory. It's Terry.
Jack Reynolds, the only man in human history to confuse Dory Funk Jr. with Terry Funk. Whatever. This is just awesome stuff from Saito. I love him so much. And I talked about how Ivan Koloff is the greatest Soviet heel character during the Cold War era. I'm thinking of Japanese heels. And I don't know if Mr. Saito is the greatest out of all of them. He probably isn't. But I have to say, given the time period that he works in, and yeah, there's a bit of selection bias here on my part, he's probably my favorite Japanese heel because you always have to take him seriously no matter what situation he's in. Even if he's trying to break a block of wood with his head and it fails.
Hey kids, I know a secret magic number. Dial this number, and just like magic, you'll hear adventure stories, scary stories, funny stories, all kinds of stories. Better ask your mom first. But you have to know the secret magic number for Story Foam. Write it down. We don't want everyone to have it. How do you get that number?
One day.
Write the number down, kids. 976-3636.
Yeah, that's just what we want to accomplish, is have young children dialing 976 numbers and incurring charges on their parents' phone bill. They do say, yeah, better ask your mom, but they don't say how much it is. And there was various 976 scams through that era, just in reading about 976 numbers, inducing young children to dial the number, banking on the notion they will be unaware of the charges that will be incurred. Of course, they don't mention how much it is in the damn ad. One variant targeted at children too young to dial a number enticed children to hold the phone up to the television set while the DTMF tones of the number were played. This type of scam was especially popular in the late 80s to early 90s in the United States before tougher regulations on the 900 number business forced many of them to close. So yeah, 976 number is certainly a creature of the 1980s. For our next ad, I'm going to throw out an additional listener discretion is advised, because this is going to blow the fucking mind of anybody under the age of 40, of which I am just barely.
I've tried fad diets, powders, pills, still my weight's been up and down like a yo-yo, until the AIDS plan taught me how to take off weight and help keep it off.
Oh no.
AIDS may taste like a candy, but AIDS contains one of the most effective appetite suppressants you can buy.
Oh no.
And there's no stimulant in AIDS that could make you nervous.
Oh no.
With AIDS, I ate less, so the weight came off. To help keep it off when I sometimes want things loaded with calories,
of course
AIDS
it did.
Helps put me in control.
The AIDS plan can teach you how to take off weight and help keep it off. Try new peanut butter AIDS.
All right, I'll keep that in mind for peanut butter AIDS. So anybody under the age of 40, which includes me, could probably not remember that candy being on the market as a appetite suppressant, because clearly by the time 1986 or so rolled around, you couldn't really have a candy named something that sounds like the most famous deadly disease in the United States at that time. Talk about the worst luck ever. In terms of naming a product, there was some company that actually bought the name for that in 1981. And think of how AIDS was, I guess, technically discovered in the U.S. in 81 in terms of identifying it and its link to HIV. I was going to do a whole jag about 22 minutes long about the history of AIDS in the 80s in the United States, because I go down quite a rabbit hole every time when I delve into this subject. Blood transfusions, the origin stuff, the patient zero business, which I don't think there's anything truly definitive about that. But Jesus Christ, listen to that commercial. I thought I was watching a Broadway production for the amount of times that they were saying AIDS. But needless to say, this is the type of thing that wasn't going to stick around for a while. Oh my God, peanut butter AIDS. I know, I feel awful for making light of it, but it is what it is. The Hotel Seville is an ad that's up next. Madison and 29th in New York City is actually now the James, New York. So I don't know if anybody is staying there for WrestleMania. I'm sure it'd be a pretty easy trip up to Penn Station, take the train over to MetLife Stadium. You know, I should probably actually think about getting a WrestleMania ticket already, considering I have my hotel and I've paid for a tailgate, but I have not actually gotten a ticket to any events. So up next, we have Mr. USA, Tony Atlas, alongside Jack Reynolds. And he's coming off a tag team title reign in the WWF that had ended about 4 months before this with Rocky Johnson. As I've mentioned many times, the two guys didn't get along. But Atlas had other issues, such as drugs, that kind of led him to going out the door. So he turns up here in Pro Wrestling USA, where he's teaming with Butch Reed very early on in this promotion's short-lived history. But he's solo on this one, and it's story time with the future Saba Simba.
You know, when I was a little kid, I used to get up and sweep the floor. And the floor I used to sweep was dirt. I used to get up early in the morning, I used to break ice in order to wash my face. Shake a little snow off my blanket because the roof had a lot of holes in it. And then all of a sudden, I became one of the best things that ever happened today in my life. I became a professional wrestler. And becoming a professional wrestler was better than me. Becoming a bodybuilder and winning the USA title was better than winning all them weightlifting contests. And it was better than anything that ever happened for me.
Jeez, if only he could have told Vince McMahon that story in 1991 when he's there as Saba Simba, that, you know, pro wrestling is better than bodybuilding and maybe Vince doesn't start the WBF, although we would have lost a great deal of unintentional comedy.
I wouldn't be the man that I am today. I don't take credit for nothing I do. I give all the credit to people like Vern Gagne and all the fans that pushed me all through the years.
Ah, yes, that noted champion of African-American advancement in the world of professional wrestling, Vern Gagne. That promo was really good until he got to the part where it's like, I have to thank Vern Gagne and the fans. Like, come on, Tony, for God's sakes. I know you're grateful that he gave you a job when you were probably maybe down a little bit and having issues, but for God's sakes, I mean, you don't have to go that far with it. It makes me feel kind of dirty listening to it. So we go from that, issues of race, and that make me feel dirty, to a match between Harley Race and Dirty Dutch Mantel. I know that that's really a stretch, but that was the best segue that I could come up with on short notice. But we can't have a simple match between two named guys like this without yet another gaffe from Jack Reynolds.
Entering the ring right now is the former AWA wrestling champion, the one and only Harley Race.
He was a 7 times NWA World's Heavyweight Champion.
I beg your pardon, NWA Champion.
Can you imagine Harley working as the AWA champion under Vern? And like Vern goes to him and is like, I need you to team with my son Greg tonight against Patera and Blackwell. No fucking way am I teaming with your motherfucking son again, all right? You got that? Are we clear? I feel like it would go something like that. So he's bouncing around a little bit beyond Central States, where he is kind of the top guy in that area, in Kansas City and into St. Louis. He's facing Ric Flair in rematches here and there. Also had a 60-minute draw with the AWA champion, Rick Martel, in October. So that is coming up. Dutch Mantel, he is mainly in Memphis, if I remember correctly. I probably should have written down what he was up to at this point. But this match, the way it plays out, is certainly bizarre when you consider that Dutch Mantel, yeah, he's a more of a territory-based guy who bounced around and not on the level of Harley Race. But this is over so quick, it's kind of surprising. You think it would get 5 or 6 minutes, but it gets less than half of that. Dirty blocks a left. I call him Dirty because that's what Ray Combs called him on Family Feud, as referenced many episodes ago. And a side headlock, and he throws off Harley, who hits him with a knee to the gut. So that's pretty much it for Dirty Dutch Mantel's offense in this one. And walking around ringside is, quote, the Sheik. Now, this had happened the week before as well, and I was very confused because when he's saying the Sheik is walking around ringside, I was like, what is Ed Farhat doing in Pro Wrestling USA? But it's actually in reference to Sheik Adnan LKC, so you can kind of slump your shoulders because there ain't going to be any fire being thrown. A classic knee drop by Harley as he just goes to work on offense. And it's not quite so deliberate this time because, like I said, this is a very quick match. He's just measuring Mantel in the corner. And he hits a pile driver. And to my shock, Mantel kicks out at 2. And I say to my shock because we're in Memphis here. This is where the pile driver is basically equivalent with certain death. And then he gets a delayed vertical suplex, Davey Boy Smith style, 7 years ahead when he made that commonplace. He holds him up for at least 10 seconds. and he goes for the pin, and Dutch kicks out, but not until 3.05, which I thought was kind of a odd move there. So Harley Race ends up picking up the win in what was a kind of surprising squash, which, by the way, sounds like a band name that would play at like the 9:30 club in Washington, D.C. or something like that. Surprise squash. So 2 minutes and 2 seconds on this one. Harley Race still got it in 1984. He, as I said, he bounces around. I'm of the belief that the King gimmick in the WWF, if you're going to give him a gimmick, at least it was something that acknowledged his lengthy history in wrestling rather than just pretending that he was some rookie coming in at the age of 44 or whatever. And he had done it all to this point. So for the guy who's done it all like him for over a decade, you know, dating back to his first world title reign, what else is there really left for him to do? Go to the commercial break. There's an ad for like the fake gold bracelets and stuff where they're like retail price for $4,000, and but you could get it here for $19.95. And then they're like, call now and you'll get a free ring and a free other bracelet. It's like, okay, all right. I'm rolling my eyes. They're going in the back of my head, but I will say these people actually accept CODs, because later in the 80s, all those ads are like, CODs not accepted. This one actually said at the top of the screen that COD would be a accepted form of payment. And then finally, they wrap up the show. Jack is there, and Bob Backlund has mysteriously appeared again, and he is smiling into the camera. It is a little bit creepy, the way he's doing it. So he's just going to take it home by giving us his thoughts on.
Well, boy, it was an enjoyable hour. It was a lot of fun. I don't know if those people out there are as excited as I am, but I've really enjoyed this hour, and I can't wait to get to come back and be with Pro Wrestling USA next week.
Yeah, you just sound positively thrilled to be there. There's so much conviction in your voice as you were reading those cue cards just like you did earlier. Oh my goodness, what an absolute mess this was. But that is a wrap for Pro Wrestling USA, the second episode from October 6th, 1984. In other podcasts this week, on the Our Vantage Point podcast, Joe Marotta and Michael Quinn continue their Royal Rankings series on announcers, and this week they get to Jim Ross and Gorilla Monsoon. One of them has a podcast, and the other, I wish was still alive and had a podcast, because I'm just imagining in my head a Gorilla Monsoon podcast where he just keeps total kayfabe the entire time, and everybody, even, you know, the smarkiest of smarks, just falls in love with it because of how great it is that he just continues to cling to that kayfabe. Sort of, oh, I would absolutely love that, and I would listen to that, like, oh my god, it's so great. On the Wrestling Podcast About Nothing with Ring of Honor's Brian Malonis and Mike Crockett. Yes, I put Malonis first on that this week. I figure I should just rotate the names. I guess I should with Quinn and Murata as well. They have on a long time New England independent wrestling veteran Johnny Vegas, and they did not ask the question of whether he is actually related to Vinny Vegas. That's something I wish that they would have gone into, since they did have about 45 minutes with him. I don't know. Maybe they just assume that the answer is yes, and that we should just believe that. And on the Sportscasters with my Adams Division podcast partner Steve Bennett, that is actually dark this week, but go back into the archives. So many great interviews with so many big names. He's got Jeff Perlman coming up in a couple of weeks, and I'm very excited for that, because I want to say he's probably my favorite regular guest, either him or Richard Deitch, because, you know, they don't hold anything back on that show. It's always an enjoyable listen. So the Sportscasters with Steve Bennett. And yes, I've been promising that Adam's Division podcast on the Royal Rumbles, and it might be the next Royal Rumble by the time we actually get to it, but we're working on scheduling something with that. I'm very busy right now. In fact, I'm recording this last part of the podcast. I'm going to pull back the curtain. I'm going to put the laundry out on the line and just air it all out there. It's 9:48 on Wednesday evening. The way I used to record this was I would have everything done by like Tuesday morning, and I would give the whole thing a listen and go back and do edits if need be. Now I really don't see the value in doing that, in part because I just don't have the time to go back and edit every last word that I say. And I started recording this a couple days ago, and it's not like I can remember everything that I said. I try to keep track. You know, if I refer back to something, hopefully I get it right. So I'm just hoping there's no obvious continuity error, like when in the Goonies at the end when they refer to the octopus in a scene that was cut. Although I'm not really cutting a whole lot that I say earlier. I mean, I'll go into a jag like my 22-minute thing about AIDS in the 80s that I'll just cut out because there's really no time for it. But before I bring this one home, I want to take on another edition of YouTube Comment Theater. As always, these are actual YouTube comments left by presumably actual users who I hope to God are subscribing to my YouTube channel, which is about 65 away from 1,000, so let's keep that push going. I mean, it may be working, me saying this. I mean, I've gotten a hell of a lot closer than I was before. So let's start out here with James Fix, who says, I don't know who the guy is talking alongside of Terry Funk, but he should have done his homework before becoming an announcer. He didn't know the names of some wrestlers or where Harley Race was champion. Other than this guy, it was a great video. Yeah, Jack Reynolds was way the hell off his game on this, and I don't know what the hell was wrong with him. Maybe he helped himself to too much peanut butter AIDS candy. I think that that's probably what it was. Frank McCutcheon asks, what channel did Pro Wrestling USA used to be on? Well, this one came off WPIX Channel 11 in New York, which was one of the two superstations in the city. WOR Channel 9 is the other one. Just like WTBS in Atlanta, WSBK in Boston, WGN in Chicago, able to beam out to a wider audience. But this was syndicated in various cities around the country. I'm just, you know, give the main one in New York. J.D. Hogg says, Jimmy Valiant had lost his cool by this time. He was much better as Handsome Jimmy than the Boogie Woogie Man. And it seems like he was kind of going by both here, where he was sort of crossing Handsome Jimmy Valiant with the Boogie Woogie Man. I mean, there's no reason why he has to go with one or the other. You know, guys can have more than one nickname. In fact, I love athletes with, like, three nicknames. It feels like something from, like, the 40s when, like, Ted Williams would be the Kid, the Splendid Splinter, and Teddy Ballgame. I mean, all of them are just outstanding nicknames. Dante Goodman says, Private Call, the 80s smartphone. And I don't know if it was like a cell phone or anything like that. It just struck me as more of like a private line, I guess. And finally, Peter Apostolakos says, Mr. Saito has a Japanese armbar? Ha ha. Well, to be fair, Jack Reynolds couldn't keep track of where Harley Race wrestled and that it's Jerry the King Lawler and not Tom Lawler. So how is he going to know that the name is a Fujiwara armbar instead of a Japanese armbar? I think it was just safe of him to say that. And if it was Gordon Solie, he probably would have called it an Oriental armbar. But Solie isn't going to show up until the episode about 2 or 3 weeks after this, when the Jack Reynolds taping has run its course. And that'll do it for YouTube Comment Theater. Believe it or not, I actually have a plan for a show next week. And it's very similar to the first Greetings from Allentown episode I did, in that it is a 1986 episode of the WWF Superstars of Wrestling. And this one will be the November 22nd edition. And I was thinking when I saw the Honky Tonk Man was going into the WWE Hall of Fame, I guess now it's financially worthwhile for him or whatever, that he has a role in this episode as kind of a secondary figure. It's not the big angle on the show, but the results of his vote of confidence poll, which kind of kicks off his heel turn, which is obviously much needed. But the main part of this episode is a matchup for the Intercontinental title between Macho Man Randy Savage and Ricky the Dragon Steamboat. And if you know anything about that feud, you know that a ring bell may be involved at some point, because it always seemed to kind of make its way into the ring when those two guys would have a big match on TV. We're also going to see other guys who are passing through the WWF who had rather interesting runs around this time, such as the Rebel Dick Slater, Billy Jack Haynes, and we'll also see Danny Davis, the referee, screwing over some baby faces. So it should be one hell of a time next Thursday. Thank you so much for listening. And don't forget to leave 5 stars on iTunes, Apple Music, if you haven't already. That does provide what is known as social proof that you're listening to this podcast and enjoying this podcast as well. And as always, word of mouth is very helpful in increasing the audience of a podcast. And I appreciate it if you get one of those generic questions like, what's a good podcast to listen to? Tell them about Greetings from Allentown and this guy who plays a bunch of sports clips and starts talking about AIDS candy and all this other stuff that gets weaved into this show that I don't really think you could find anywhere else. It has certainly become a unique thing that I do every week in my basement. And yes, I am literally in my basement right now. So once again, thanks for listening and tune in next Thursday for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.
The AIDS plan can teach you how to take off weight and help keep it off. Try new peanut butter AIDS.